really needed for his survival and reproduction. It is certainly true that all instincts, drives, and emotions evolved in order to meet the evolutionary pressures of survival and reproduction. However, if and when these pressures suddenly disappear, the instincts, drives, and emotions they had shaped do not disappear with them. At least, not instantly. Even if they are no longer instrumental for survival and reproduction, these instincts, drives, and emotions continue to mold the subjective experiences of the animal. For animals and humans alike, agriculture changed selection pressures almost overnight, but it did not change their physical, emotional, and social drives. Of course, evolution never stands still, and it has continued to modify humans and animals in the 12,000 years since the advent of farming. For example, humans in Europe and Western Asia evolved the ability to digest cow's milk, while cows lost their fear of humans, and today produce far more milk than their wild ancestors. Yet these are superficial alterations. The deep sensory and emotional structures of cows, pigs, and humans alike haven't changed much since the Stone Age. Why do modern humans love sweets so much? Not because in the early 21st century we must gorge on ice cream and chocolate in order to survive. Rather, it is because when our Stone Age ancestors came across sweet fruit or honey, the most sensible thing to do was to eat as much of it as quickly as possible. Why do young men drive recklessly, get involved in violent arguments, and hack confidential internet sites? Because they are following ancient genetic decrees that might be useless and even counterproductive today, but that made good evolutionary sense 70,000 years ago. A young hunter who risked his life chasing a mammoth outshone all his competitors and won the hand of the local beauty, and we are now stuck with his macho genes. Exactly the same evolutionary logic shapes the lives of pigs, sows, and piglets in human-controlled farms. In order to survive and reproduce in the wild, ancient boars needed to roam vast territories, familiarize themselves with their environment, and beware of traps and predators. They further needed to communicate and cooperate with their fellow boars, forming complex groups dominated by old and experienced matriarchs. Evolutionary pressures consequently made wild boars, and even more so wild sows, highly intelligent social animals, characterized by a lively curiosity and strong urges to socialize, play, wander about, and explore their surroundings. A sow born with some rare mutation that made her indifferent to her environment and to other boars was unlikely to survive or reproduce. The descendants of wild boars, domesticated pigs, inherited their intelligence, curiosity, and social skills. Like wild boars, domesticated pigs communicate using a rich variety of vocal and olfactory signals. Mother sows recognize the unique squeaks of their piglets, whereas two-day-old piglets already differentiate their mother's calls from those of other sows. Professor Stanley Curtis of the Pennsylvania State University trained two pigs, named Hamlet and Omelette, to control a special joystick with their snouts, and found that the pigs soon rivaled primates in learning and playing simple computer games. Today, most sows in industrial farms don't play computer games. They are locked by their human masters in tiny gestation crates, usually measuring 2 meters by 60 centimeters. The crates have a concrete floor and metal bars, and hardly allow the pregnant sows even to turn around or sleep on their side, never mind walk. After 3.5 months in such conditions, the sows are moved to slightly wider crates where they give birth and nurse their piglets. Whereas piglets would naturally suckle for 10 to 20 weeks, in industrial farms they are forcibly weaned within 2 to 4 weeks, separated from their mother, and shipped to be fattened and slaughtered. The mother is immediately impregnated again and sent back to the gestation crate to start another cycle. The typical sow would go through 5 to 10 such cycles before being slaughtered herself. In recent years, the use of crates has been restricted in the European Union and some US states, but the crates are still commonly used in many other countries, and tens of millions of breeding sows pass almost their entire lives in them. The human farmers take care of everything the sow needs in order to survive and reproduce. She is given enough food, vaccinated against diseases, protected against the elements, and artificially inseminated. From an objective perspective, the sow no longer needs to explore her surroundings, socialize with other pigs, bond with her piglets, or even walk. But from a subjective perspective, the sow still feels very strong urges to do all of these things, and if these urges are not fulfilled, she suffers greatly. Sows locked in gestation crates typically display acute frustration, alternating with extreme despair. This is the basic lesson of evolutionary psychology. A need shaped thousands of generations ago continues to be felt subjectively, even if it is no longer necessary for survival and reproduction in the present. Tragically, the agricultural revolution gave humans the power to ensure the survival and reproduction of domesticated animals, while ignoring their subjective needs. Organisms are algorithms. How can we be sure that animals such as pigs actually have a subjective world of needs, sensations, and emotions? Aren't we guilty of humanizing animals? That is, ascribing human qualities to non-human entities, like children believing that dolls feel love and anger. In fact, attributing emotions to pigs doesn't humanize them. It mammalizes them. For emotions are not a uniquely human quality. They are common to all mammals, as well as to all birds, and probably to some reptiles and even fish. All mammals evolved emotional abilities and needs, and from the fact that pigs are mammals, we can safely deduce that they have emotions. In recent decades, life scientists have demonstrated that emotions are not some mysterious spiritual phenomenon that is useful just for writing poetry and composing symphonies. Rather, emotions are biochemical algorithms that are vital for the survival and reproduction of all mammals. What does this mean? Well, let's begin by explaining what an algorithm is. This is of great importance, not only because this key concept will reappear in many of the following chapters, but also because the 21st century will be dominated by algorithms. Algorithm is arguably the single most important concept in our world. If we want to understand our life and our future, we should make every effort to understand what an algorithm is and how algorithms are connected with emotions. An algorithm is a methodical set of steps that can be used to make calculations, resolve problems, and reach decisions. An algorithm isn't a particular calculation, but the method followed when making the calculation. For example, if you want to calculate the average between two numbers, you can use a simple algorithm. The algorithm says, first step, add the two numbers together. Second step, divide the sum by two. When you enter the numbers 4 and 8, you get 6. When you enter 117 and 231, you get 174. A more complex example is a cooking recipe. An algorithm for preparing vegetable soup may tell us 1. Heat half a cup of oil in a pot. 2. Finely chop 4 onions. 3. Fry the onion until golden. 4. Cut 3 potatoes into chunks and add to the pot. 5. Slice a cabbage into strips and add to the pot. And so forth. You can follow the same algorithm dozens of times, each time using slightly different vegetables, and therefore getting a slightly different soup. But the algorithm remains the same. A recipe by itself cannot make soup. You need a person to read the recipe and follow the prescribed set of steps. But you can build a machine that embodies this algorithm and follows it automatically. Then you just need to provide the machine with water, electricity, and vegetables, and it will prepare the soup by itself. There aren't many soup machines around, but you are probably familiar with beverage vending machines. Such machines usually have a slot for coins, an opening for cups, and rows of buttons. The first row has buttons for coffee, tea, and cocoa. The second row is marked, no sugar, one spoon of sugar, 2 spoons of sugar. The third row indicates milk, soya milk, no milk. A man approaches the machine, inserts a coin into the slot, and presses the buttons marked tea, 1 sugar, and milk. The machine kicks into action, following a precise set of steps. It drops a tea bag into a cup, pours boiling water, adds a spoonful of sugar and milk, and ding! A nice cup of tea emerges. This is an algorithm. Over the last few decades, biologists have reached the firm conclusion that the man pressing the buttons and drinking the tea is also an algorithm. A much more complicated algorithm than the vending machine, no doubt, but still an algorithm. Humans are algorithms that produce not cups of tea, but copies of themselves. Like a vending machine which, if you press the right combination of buttons, produces another vending machine. The algorithms controlling vending machines work through mechanical gears and electric circuits. The algorithms controlling humans work through sensations, emotions, and thoughts. And exactly the same kind of algorithms control pigs, baboons, otters, and chickens. Consider, for example, the following survival problem. A baboon spots some bananas hanging on a tree, but also notices a lion lurking nearby. Should the baboon risk his life for those bananas? This boils down to a mathematical problem of calculating probabilities. The probability that the baboon will die of hunger if it does not eat the bananas versus the probability that the lion will catch the baboon. In order to solve this problem, the baboon needs to take into account a lot of data. How far am I from the bananas? How far away is the lion? How fast can I run? How fast can the lion run? Is the lion awake or asleep? Does the lion seem to be hungry or satiated? How many bananas are there? Are they big or small? Green or ripe? In addition to these external data, the baboon must also consider information about conditions within his own body. If he is starving, it makes sense to risk everything for those bananas, no matter the odds. In contrast, if he has just eaten, and the bananas are mere greed, why take any risks at all? In order to weigh and balance all these variables and probabilities, the baboon requires far more complicated algorithms than the ones controlling automatic vending machines. The prize for making correct calculations is correspondingly greater. The prize is the very survival of the baboon. A timid baboon, one whose algorithms overestimate dangers, will starve to death, and the genes that shaped these cowardly algorithms will perish with him. A rash baboon, one whose algorithms underestimate dangers, will fall prey to the lion, and his reckless genes will also fail to make it to the next generation. These algorithms undergo constant quality control by natural selection. Only animals that calculate probabilities correctly leave offspring behind. Yes, this is all very abstract. How exactly does a baboon calculate probabilities? He certainly doesn't draw a pencil from behind his ear, a notebook from a back pocket, and start computing running speeds and energy levels with a calculator. Rather, the baboon's entire body is the calculator. What we call sensations and emotions are in fact algorithms. The baboon feels hunger. He feels fear and trembling at the sight of the lion, and he feels his mouth watering at the sight of the bananas. Within a split second, he experiences a storm of sensations, emotions, and desires, which is nothing but the process of calculation. The result will appear as a feeling. The baboon will suddenly feel his spirit rising, his hairs standing on end, his muscles tensing, his chest expanding, and he will inhale a big breath and, "Forward, I can do it! To the bananas!" Alternatively, he may be overcome by fear. His shoulders will droop, his stomach will turn, his legs will give way, and, "Mama, a lion! Help!" Sometimes the probabilities match so evenly that it is hard to decide. This too will manifest itself as a feeling. The baboon will feel confused and indecisive. "Yes, no. Yes, no. Damn, I don't know what to do." In order to transmit genes to the next generation, it is not enough to solve survival problems. Animals also need to solve reproduction problems too, and this depends on calculating probabilities. Natural selection evolved passion and disgust as quick algorithms for evaluating reproduction odds. Beauty means good chances for having successful offspring. When a woman sees a man and thinks, "Wow, he is gorgeous," and when a peahen sees a peacock and thinks, "Jesus, what a tail," they are doing something similar to the automatic vending machine. As light reflected from the male's body hits their retinas, extremely powerful algorithms, honed by millions of years of evolution, kick in. Within a few milliseconds, the algorithms convert tiny cues in the male's external appearance into reproduction probabilities and reach the conclusion, in all likelihood, this is a very healthy and fertile male with excellent genes. If I mate with him, my offspring are also likely to enjoy good health and excellent genes. Of course, this conclusion is not spelled out in words or numbers, but in the fiery itch of sexual attraction. Peahens, and most women, don't make such calculations with pen and paper. They just feel them. Even Nobel laureates in economics make only a tiny fraction of their decisions using pen, paper, and calculator. 99% of our decisions, including the most important life choices concerning spouses, careers, and habitats, are made by the highly refined algorithms we call sensations, emotions, and desires. Because these algorithms control the lives of all mammals and birds, and probably some reptiles and even fish, when humans, baboons, and pigs feel fear, similar neurological processes take place in similar brain areas. It is therefore likely that frightened humans, frightened baboons, and frightened pigs have similar experiences. There are differences too, of course. Pigs don't seem to experience the extremes of compassion and cruelty that characterize Homo sapiens, nor the sense of wonder that overwhelms a human gazing up at the infinitude of a starry sky. It is likely that there are also opposite examples of swinish emotions unfamiliar to humans, but I cannot name any, for obvious reasons. However, one core emotion is apparently shared by all mammals, the mother-infant bond. Indeed, it gives mammals their name. The word mammal comes from the Latin mamma, meaning breast. Mammal mothers love their offspring so much that they allow them to suckle from their body. Mammal youngsters, on their side, feel an overwhelming desire to bond with their mothers and stay near them. In the wild, piglets, calves, and puppies that fail to bond with their mothers rarely survive for long. Until recently, that was true of human children too. Conversely, a sow, cow, or bitch that, due to some rare mutation, does not care about her young, may live a long and comfortable life, but her genes will not pass to the next generation. The same logic is true among giraffes, bats, whales, and porcupines. We can argue about other emotions, but since mammal youngsters cannot survive without motherly care, it is evident that motherly love and a strong mother-infant bond characterize all mammals. It took scientists many years to acknowledge this. Not long ago, psychologists doubted the importance of the emotional bond between parents and children, even among humans. In the first half of the 20th century, and despite the influence of Freudian theories, the dominant behaviorist school argued that relations between parents and children were shaped by material feedback, that children needed mainly food, shelter, and medical care, and that children bonded with their parents simply because the latter provided these material needs. Children who demanded warmth, hugs, and kisses were thought to be spoiled. Childcare experts warned that children who were hugged and kissed by their parents would grow up to be needy, egotistical, and insecure adults. John Watson, a leading childcare authority in the 1920s, sternly advised parents, "Never hug and kiss your children. Never let them sit in your lap. If you must, kiss them once on the forehead when they say goodnight. Shake hands with them in the morning." The popular magazine Infant Care explained that the secret of raising children is to maintain discipline and to provide the children's material needs according to a strict daily schedule. A 1929 article instructed parents that if an infant cries out for food before the normal feeding time, do not hold him nor rock him to stop his crying, and do not nurse him until the exact hour for the feeding comes. It will not hurt the baby, even the tiny baby, to cry. Only in the 1950s and 1960s did a growing consensus of experts abandon these strict behaviorist theories and acknowledge the central importance of emotional needs. In a series of famous and shockingly cruel experiments, the psychologist Harry Harlow separated infant monkeys from their mothers shortly after birth and isolated them in small cages. When given a choice between a metal dummy mother fitted with a milk bottle and a soft cloth-covered dummy with no milk, the baby monkeys clung to the barren cloth mother for all they were worth. Those baby monkeys knew something that John Watson and the experts of infant care failed to realize. Mammals can't live on food alone. They need emotional bonds, too. Millions of years of evolution pre-programmed the monkeys with an overwhelming desire for emotional bonding. Evolution also imprinted them with the assumption that emotional bonds are more likely to be formed with soft, furry things than with hard and metallic objects. This is also why small human children are far more likely to become attached to dolls, blankets, and smelly rags than to cutlery, stones, or wooden blocks. The need for emotional bonds is so strong that Harlow's baby monkeys abandoned the nourishing metal dummy and turned their attention to the only object that seemed capable of answering that need. Alas, the cloth mother never responded to their affection, and the little monkeys consequently suffered from severe psychological and social problems and grew up to be neurotic and asocial adults. Today we look back with incomprehension at early 20th century child-rearing advice. How could experts fail to appreciate that children have emotional needs and that their mental and physical health depends as much on providing for these needs as on food, shelter, and medicines? Yet, when it comes to other mammals, we keep denying the obvious. Like John Watson and the infant care experts, farmers throughout history took care of the material needs of piglets, calves, and kids, but tended to ignore their emotional needs. Thus, both the meat and dairy industries are based on breaking the most fundamental emotional bond in the mammal kingdom. Farmers get their breeding sows and dairy cows impregnated again and again. Yet the piglets and calves are separated from their mothers shortly after birth, and often pass their days without ever sucking at her teats or feeling the warm touch of her tongue and body. What Harry Harlow did to a few hundred monkeys, the meat and dairy industries are doing to billions of animals every year. The agricultural deal. How did farmers justify their behavior? Whereas hunter-gatherers were seldom aware of the damage they inflicted on the ecosystem, farmers knew perfectly well what they were doing. They knew they were exploiting domesticated animals and subjecting them to human desires and whims. They justified their actions in the name of new theist religions, which mushroomed and spread in the wake of the agricultural revolution. Theist religions maintained that the universe is ruled by a group of great gods, or perhaps by a single capital G God. We don't normally associate this idea with agriculture, but at least in their beginnings, theist religions were an agricultural enterprise. The theology, mythology, and liturgy of religions such as Judaism, Hinduism, and Christianity revolved at first around the relationship between humans, domesticated plants, and farm animals. Biblical Judaism, for instance, catered to peasants and shepherds. Most of its commandments dealt with farming and village life, and its major holidays were harvest festivals. People today imagine the ancient temple in Jerusalem as a kind of big synagogue where priests clad in snow-white robes welcomed devout pilgrims, melodious choirs sang psalms, and incense perfumed the air. In reality, it looked much more like a cross between a slaughterhouse and a barbecue joint than a modern synagogue. The pilgrims did not come empty-handed. They brought with them a never-ending stream of sheep goats, chickens, and other animals, which were sacrificed at the god's altar and then cooked and eaten. The psalm-singing choirs could hardly be heard over the bellowing and bleating of calves and kids. Priests in blood-stained outfits cut the victim's throat, collected the gushing blood in jars, and spilled it over the altar. The perfume of incense mixed with the odors of congealed blood and roasted meat, while swarms of black flies buzzed just about everywhere. See, for example, Numbers chapter 28, Deuteronomy chapter 12, and 1 Samuel chapter 2. A modern Jewish family that celebrates a holiday by having a barbecue on their front lawn is much closer to the spirit of biblical times than an Orthodox family that spends the time studying scriptures in a synagogue. Theist religions, such as biblical Judaism, justify the agricultural economy through new cosmological myths. Animist religions had previously depicted the universe as a grand Chinese opera with a limitless cast of colorful actors. Elephants and oak trees, crocodiles and rivers, mountains and frogs, ghosts and fairies, angels and demons, each had a role in the cosmic opera. Theist religions rewrote the script, turning the universe into a bleak Ibsen drama with just two main characters, man and God. The angels and demons somehow survived the transition, becoming the messengers and servants of the great gods. Yet the rest of the animist cast, all the animals, plants, and other natural phenomena, were transformed into silent decor. True, some animals were considered sacred to this or that god, and many gods had animal features. The Egyptian god Anubis had the head of a jackal, and even Jesus Christ was frequently depicted as a lamb. Yet ancient Egyptians could easily tell the difference between Anubis and an ordinary jackal sneaking into the village to hunt chickens, and no Christian butcher ever mistook the lamb under his knife for Jesus. We normally think that theist religions sanctified the great gods. We tend to forget that they sanctified humans too. Hitherto, Homo sapiens had been just one actor in a cast of thousands. In the new theist drama, sapiens became the central hero around whom the entire universe revolved. The gods, meanwhile, were given two related roles to play. Firstly, they explained what is so special about sapiens, and why humans should dominate and exploit all other organisms. Christianity, for example, maintained that humans hold sway over the rest of creation because the Creator charged them with that authority. Moreover, according to Christianity, God gave an eternal soul only to humans. Since the fate of this eternal soul is the point of the whole Christian cosmos, and since animals have no soul, they are mere extras. Humans thus became the apex of creation, while all other organisms were pushed to the sidelines. Secondly, the gods had to mediate between humans and the ecosystem. In the animistic cosmos, everyone talked with everyone directly. If you needed something from the caribou, the fig trees, the clouds, or the rocks, you addressed them yourself. In the theist cosmos, all non-human entities were silenced. Consequently, you could no longer talk with trees and animals. What to do, then, when you wanted the trees to give more fruits, the cows to give more milk, the clouds to bring more rain, and the locusts to stay away from your crops? That's where the gods entered the picture. They promised to supply rain, fertility, and protection, provided humans did something in return. This was the essence of the agricultural deal. The gods safeguarded and multiplied farm production, and in exchange, humans had to share the produce with the gods. This deal served both parties, at the expense of the rest of the ecosystem. Today in Nepal, devotees of the goddess Godimai celebrate her festival every 5 years in the village of Bariapur. A record was set in 2009 when 250,000 animals were sacrificed to the goddess. A local driver explained to a visiting British journalist that, "If we want anything, and we come here with an offering to the goddess, within 5 years all our dreams will be fulfilled." Much of theist mythology explains the subtle details of this deal. The Mesopotamian Gilgamesh epic recounts that when the gods sent a great deluge to destroy the world, almost all humans and animals perished. Only then did the rash gods realize that nobody remained to make any offerings to them. They became crazed with hunger and distress. Luckily, one human family survived, thanks to the foresight of the god Enki, who instructed his devotee Utnapishtim to take shelter in a large wooden ark along with his relatives and a menagerie of animals. When the deluge subsided and this Mesopotamian Noah emerged from his ark, the first thing he did was sacrifice some animals to the gods. Then, tells the epic, all the great gods rushed to the spot. The gods smelled the savor. The gods smelled the sweet savor. The gods swarmed like flies around the offering. The biblical story of the deluge, written more than 1,000 years after the Mesopotamian version, also reports that immediately upon leaving the ark, Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans." Genesis chapter 8, verses 20 and 21. This deluge story became a founding myth of the agricultural world. It is possible, of course, to give it a modern environmentalist spin. The deluge could teach us that our actions can ruin the entire ecosystem, and humans are divinely charged with protecting the rest of creation. Yet traditional interpretations saw the deluge as proof of human supremacy and animal worthlessness. According to these interpretations, Noah was instructed to save the whole ecosystem in order to protect the common interests of gods and humans rather than the interests of the animals. Non-human organisms have no intrinsic value and exist solely for our sake. After all, when the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become, he resolved to wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. Genesis chapter 6, verse 7. The Bible thinks it is perfectly all right to destroy all animals as punishment for the crimes of Homo sapiens, as if the existence of giraffes, pelicans, and ladybirds has lost all purpose if humans misbehave. The Bible could not imagine a scenario in which God repents having created Homo sapiens, wipes this sinful ape off the face of the earth, and then spends eternity enjoying the antics of ostriches, kangaroos, and panda bears. Theist religions, nevertheless, have certain animal-friendly beliefs. The gods gave humans authority over the animal kingdom, but this authority carried with it some responsibilities. For example, Jews were commanded to allow farm animals to rest on the Sabbath, and, whenever possible, to avoid causing them unnecessary suffering. Though, whenever interests clashed, human interests always trumped animal interests. A Talmudic tale recounts how on the way to the slaughterhouse, a calf escaped and sought refuge with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, one of the founders of rabbinical Judaism. The calf tucked his head under the rabbi's flowing robes and started crying. Yet the rabbi pushed the calf away, saying, "Go, you were created for that very purpose." Since the rabbi showed no mercy, God punished him, and he suffered from a painful illness for 13 years. Then, one day, a servant cleaning the rabbi's house found some newborn rats and began sweeping them out. Rabbi Yehuda rushed to save the helpless creatures, instructing the servant to leave them in peace, because God is good to all, and has compassion on all he has made. Psalms 145, chapter 9. Since the rabbi showed compassion to these rats, God showed compassion to the rabbi, and he was cured of his illness. Other religions, particularly Jainism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, have demonstrated even greater empathy to animals. They emphasize the connection between humans and the rest of the ecosystem, and their foremost ethical commandment has been to avoid killing any living being. Whereas the biblical "thou shalt not kill" covered only humans, the ancient Indian principle of ahimsa, non-violence, extends to every sentient being. Jain monks are particularly careful in this regard. They always cover their mouths with a white cloth, lest they inhale an insect. And whenever they walk, they carry a broom to gently sweep any ant or beetle from their path. Nevertheless, all agricultural religions, Jainism, Buddhism, and Hinduism included, found ways to justify human superiority and the exploitation of animals, if not for meat, then for milk and muscle power. They have all claimed that a natural hierarchy of beings entitles humans to control and use other animals, provided that the humans observe certain restrictions. Hinduism, for example, has sanctified cows and forbidden eating beef, but has also provided the ultimate justification for the dairy industry, alleging that cows are generous creatures and positively yearn to share their milk with humankind. Humans thus committed themselves to an agricultural deal. According to this deal, cosmic forces gave humans command over other animals, on condition that humans fulfilled certain obligations towards the gods, towards nature, and towards the animals themselves. It was easy to believe in the existence of such a cosmic compact, because it reflected the daily routine of farming life. Hunter-gatherers had not seen themselves as superior beings, because they were seldom aware of their impact on the ecosystem. A typical band numbered in the dozens, it was surrounded by thousands of wild animals, and its survival depended on understanding and respecting the desires of these animals. Foragers had to constantly ask themselves what deer dream about and what lions think. Otherwise, they could not hunt the deer nor escape the lions. Farmers, in contrast, lived in a world controlled and shaped by human dreams and thoughts. Humans were still subject to formidable natural forces, such as storms and earthquakes, but they were far less dependent on the wishes of other animals. A farm boy learned early on to ride a horse, harness a bull, whip a stubborn donkey, and lead the sheep to pasture. It was easy and tempting to believe that such everyday activities reflected either the natural order of things or the will of heaven. It is no coincidence that the Nayaka of southern India treat elephants, snakes, and forest trees as beings equal to humans, but have a very different view of domesticated plants and animals. In the Nayaka language, a living being possessing a unique personality is called Mansan. When probed by the anthropologist Danny Nave, they explained that all elephants are Mansan. We live in the forest. They live in the forest. We are all Mansan. So are bears, deer, and tigers. All forest animals. What about cows? Cows are different. You have to lead them everywhere. And chickens? They are nothing. They are not Mansan. And forest trees? Yes, they live for such a long time. And tea bushes? Oh, these I cultivate so that I can sell the tea leaves and buy what I need from the store. No, they aren't Mansan. We should also bear in mind how humans themselves were treated in most agricultural societies. In biblical Israel or medieval China, it was common to whip humans, enslave them, torture, and execute them. Humans were considered as mere property. Rulers did not dream of asking peasants for their opinions and cared little about their needs. Parents frequently sold their children into slavery or married them off to the highest bidder. Under such conditions, ignoring the feelings of cows and chickens was hardly surprising. 500 years of solitude. The rise of modern science and industry brought about the next revolution in human-animal relations. During the agricultural revolution, humankind silenced animals and plants and turned the animist grand opera into a dialogue between man and gods. During the scientific revolution, humankind silenced the gods too. The world was now a one-man show. Humankind stood alone on an empty stage, talking to itself, negotiating with no one, and acquiring enormous powers without any obligations. Having deciphered the mute laws of physics, chemistry, and biology, humankind now does with them as it pleases. When an archaic hunter went out to the savannah, he asked the help of the wild bull, and the bull demanded something of the hunter. When an ancient farmer wanted his cows to produce lots of milk, he asked some great heavenly god for help, and the god stipulated his conditions. When the white-coated staff in Nestlé's research and development department want to increase dairy production, they study genetics, and the genes don't ask for anything in return. But just as the hunters and farmers had their myths, so do the people in the R&D department. Their most famous myth shamelessly plagiarizes the legend of the Tree of Knowledge and the Garden of Eden, but transports the action to the garden at Woolsthorpe Manor in Lincolnshire. According to this myth, Isaac Newton was sitting there under an apple tree when a ripe apple dropped on his head. Newton began wondering why the apple fell straight downwards rather than sideways or upwards. His inquiry led him to discover gravity and the laws of Newtonian mechanics. Newton's story turns the Tree of Knowledge myth on its head. In the Garden of Eden, the serpent initiates the drama, tempting humans to sin, thereby bringing the wrath of God down upon them. Adam and Eve are a plaything for serpent and God alike. In contrast, in the Garden of Woolsthorpe, man is the sole agent. Though Newton himself was a deeply religious Christian, who devoted far more time to studying the Bible than the laws of physics, the scientific revolution that he helped launch pushed God to the sidelines. When Newton's successors came to write their Genesis myth, they had no use for either God or serpent. The Garden of Woolsthorpe is run by blind laws of nature, and the initiative to decipher these laws is strictly human. The story may begin with an apple falling on Newton's head, but the apple did not do it on purpose. In the Garden of Eden myth, humans are punished for their curiosity and for their wish to gain knowledge. God expels them from paradise. In the Garden of Woolsthorpe myth, nobody punishes Newton, just the opposite. Thanks to his curiosity, humankind gains a better understanding of the universe, becomes more powerful, and takes another step towards the technological paradise. Untold numbers of teachers throughout the world recount the Newton myth to encourage curiosity, implying that if only we gain enough knowledge, we can create paradise here on Earth. In fact, God is present even in the Newton myth. Newton himself is God. When biotechnology, nanotechnology, and the other fruits of science ripen, Homo sapiens will attain divine powers and come full circle back to the biblical tree of knowledge. Archaic hunter-gatherers were just another species of animal. Farmers saw themselves as the apex of creation. Scientists will upgrade us into gods. Whereas the agricultural revolution gave rise to theist religions, the scientific revolution gave birth to humanist religions, in which humans replaced gods. While theists worship theos, Greek for God, humanists worship humans. The founding idea of humanist religions such as liberalism, communism, and Nazism is that Homo sapiens has some unique and sacred essence that is the source of all meaning and authority in the universe. Everything that happens in the cosmos is judged to be good or bad according to its impact on Homo sapiens. Whereas theism justified traditional agriculture in the name of God, humanism has justified modern industrial farming in the name of man. Industrial farming sanctifies human needs, whims, and wishes, while disregarding everything else. Industrial farming has no real interest in animals, which don't share the sanctity of human nature. And it has no use for gods, because modern science and technology give humans powers that far exceed those of the ancient gods. Science enables modern firms to subjugate cows, pigs, and chickens to more extreme conditions than those prevailing in traditional agricultural societies. In ancient Egypt, in the Roman Empire, or in medieval China, humans had only a rudimental understanding of biochemistry, genetics, zoology, and epidemiology. Consequently, their powers of manipulation were limited. In those days, pigs, cows, and chickens ran free among the houses, and searched for edible treasures in the rubbish heap and in the nearby woods. If an ambitious peasant had tried to confine thousands of animals in a crowded coop, a deadly epidemic would probably have resulted, wiping out all the animals, as well as many of the villagers. No priest, shaman, or god could have prevented it. But once modern science deciphered the secrets of epidemics, pathogens, and antibiotics, industrial coops, pens, and pigsties became feasible. With the help of vaccinations, medications, hormones, pesticides, central air conditioning systems, and automatic feeders, it is now possible to pack tens of thousands of pigs, cows, or chickens into neat rows of cramped cages and produce meat, milk, and eggs with unprecedented efficiency. In recent years, as people began to rethink human-animal relations, such practices have come under increasing criticism. We are suddenly showing unprecedented interest in the fate of so-called lower life forms, perhaps because we are about to become one. If and when computer programs attain superhuman intelligence and unprecedented power, should we begin valuing these programs more than we value humans? Would it be okay, for example, for an artificial intelligence to exploit humans and even kill them to further its own needs and desires? If it should never be allowed to do that, despite its superior intelligence and power, why is it ethical for humans to exploit and kill pigs? Do humans have some magical spark, in addition to higher intelligence and greater power, which distinguishes them from pigs, chickens, chimpanzees, and computer programs alike? If yes, where did that spark come from, and why are we certain that an AI could never acquire it? If there is no such spark, would there be any reason to continue assigning special value to human life even after computers surpass humans in intelligence and power? Indeed, what exactly is it about humans that make us so intelligent and powerful in the first place? And how likely is it that non-human entities will ever rival and surpass us? The next chapter will examine the nature and power of Homo sapiens, not only in order to comprehend further our relations with other animals, but also to appreciate what the future might hold for us and what relations between humans and superhumans might look like. 3. The Human Spark. There is no doubt that Homo sapiens is the most powerful species in the world. Homo sapiens also likes to think that it enjoys a superior moral status, and that human life has much greater value than the lives of pigs, elephants, or wolves. This is less obvious. Does might make right? Is human life more precious than porcine life, simply because the human collective is more powerful than the pig collective? The United States is far mightier than Afghanistan. Does this imply that American lives have greater intrinsic value than Afghan lives? In practice, American lives are more valued. Far more money is invested in the education, health, and safety of the average American than of the average Afghan. Killing an American citizen creates a far greater international outcry than killing an Afghan citizen. Yet it is generally accepted that this is no more than an unjust result of the geopolitical balance of power. Afghanistan may have far less clout than the USA, yet the life of a child in the mountains of Tora Bora is considered every bit as sacred as the life of a child in Beverly Hills. In contrast, when we privilege human children over piglets, we want to believe that this reflects something deeper than the ecological balance of power. We want to believe that human lives really are superior in some fundamental way. We sapiens love telling ourselves that we enjoy some magical quality that not only accounts for our immense power, but also gives moral justification for our privileged status. What is this unique human spark? The traditional monotheist answer is that only sapiens have eternal souls. Whereas the body decays and rots, the soul journeys on towards salvation or damnation, and will experience either everlasting joy in paradise or an eternity of misery in hell. Since pigs and other animals have no soul, they don't take part in this cosmic drama. They live only for a few years, and then die and fade into nothingness. We should therefore care far more about eternal human souls than about ephemeral pigs. This is no kindergarten fairy tale, but an extremely powerful myth that continues to shape the lives of billions of humans and animals in the early 21st century. The belief that humans have eternal souls, whereas animals are just evanescent bodies, is a central pillar of our legal, political, and economic system. It explains why, for example, it is perfectly okay for humans to kill animals for food, or even just for the fun of it. However, our latest scientific discoveries flatly contradict this monotheist myth. True, laboratory experiments confirm the accuracy of one part of the myth, just as monotheist religions say animals have no souls. All the careful studies and painstaking examinations have failed to discover any trace of a soul in pigs, rats, or rhesus monkeys. Alas, the same laboratory experiments undermine the second and far more important part of the monotheist myth, namely that humans do have a soul. Scientists have subjected Homo sapiens to tens of thousands of bizarre experiments and looked into every nook in our hearts and every cranny in our brains. But they have so far discovered no magical spark. There is zero scientific evidence that, in contrast to pigs, sapiens have souls. If that were all, we could well argue that scientists just need to keep looking. If they haven't found the soul yet, it is because they haven't looked carefully enough. Yet the life sciences doubt the existence of soul not just due to lack of evidence, but rather because the very idea of soul contradicts the most fundamental principles of evolution. This contradiction is responsible for the unbridled hatred that the theory of evolution inspires among devout monotheists. Who's afraid of Charles Darwin? According to a 2012 Gallup survey, only 15% of Americans think that Homo sapiens evolved through natural selection alone, free of all divine intervention. 32% maintain that humans may have evolved from earlier life forms in a process lasting millions of years, but God orchestrated this entire show. 46% believe that God created humans in their current form sometime during the last 10,000 years, just as the Bible says. Spending 3 years in college has absolutely no impact on these views. The same survey found that among BA graduates, 46% believe in the biblical creation story, whereas only 14% think that humans evolved without any divine supervision. Even among holders of MA and PhD degrees, 25% believe the Bible, whereas only 29% credit natural selection alone with the creation of our species. Though schools evidently do a very poor job teaching evolution, religious zealots still insist that it should not be taught at all. Alternatively, they demand that children must also be taught the theory of intelligent design, according to which all organisms were created by the design of some higher intelligence, a.k.a. God. Teach them both theories, say the zealots, and let the kids decide for themselves. Why does the theory of evolution provoke such objections, whereas nobody seems to care about the theory of relativity or quantum mechanics? How come politicians don't ask that kids be exposed to alternative theories about matter, energy, space, and time? After all, Darwin's ideas seem, at first sight, far less threatening than the monstrosities of Einstein and Werner Heisenberg. The theory of evolution rests on the principle of the survival of the fittest, which is a clear and simple, not to say humdrum, idea. In contrast, the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics argue that you can twist time and space, that something can appear out of nothing, and that a cat can be both alive and dead at the same time. This makes a mockery of our common sense, yet nobody seeks to protect innocent schoolchildren from these scandalous ideas. Why? The theory of relativity makes nobody angry because it doesn't contradict any of our cherished beliefs. Most people don't care an iota whether space and time are absolute or relative. If you think it is possible to bend space and time, well, be my guest. Go ahead and bend them. What do I care? In contrast, Darwin has deprived us of our souls. If you really understand the theory of evolution, you understand that there is no soul. This is a terrifying thought not only to devout Christians and Muslims, but also to many secular people who don't hold any clear religious dogma, but nevertheless want to believe that each human possesses an eternal individual essence that remains unchanged throughout life and can survive even death intact. The literal meaning of the word individual is something that cannot be divided. That I am an individual implies that my true self is a holistic entity rather than an assemblage of separate parts. This indivisible essence allegedly endures from one moment to the next without losing or absorbing anything. My body and brain undergo a constant process of change as neurons fire, hormones flow, and muscles contract. My personality, wishes, and relationships never stand still, and may be completely transformed over years and decades. But underneath it all, I remain the same person from birth to death, and hopefully beyond death as well. Unfortunately, the theory of evolution rejects the idea that my true self is some indivisible, immutable, and potentially eternal essence. According to the theory of evolution, all biological entities, from elephants and oak trees to cells and DNA molecules, are composed of smaller and simpler parts that ceaselessly combine and separate. Elephants and cells have evolved gradually as a result of new combinations and splits. Something that cannot be divided or changed cannot have come into existence through natural selection. The human eye, for example, is an extremely complex system made of numerous smaller parts, such as the lens, the cornea, and the retina. The eye did not pop out of nowhere, complete with all these components. Rather, it evolved step by tiny step, through millions of years. Our eye is very similar to the eye of Homo erectus, who lived 1 million years ago. It is somewhat less similar to the eye of Australopithecus, who lived 5 million years ago. It is very different from the eye of Dryolestes, who lived 150 million years ago. And it seems to have nothing in common with the unicellular organisms that inhabited our planet hundreds of millions of years ago. Yet even unicellular organisms have tiny organelles that enable the microorganism to distinguish light from darkness and move towards one or the other. The path leading from such archaic senses to the human eye is long and winding, but if you have hundreds of millions of years to spare, you can certainly cover the entire path, step by step. You can do that because the eye is composed of many different parts. If every few generations a small mutation slightly changes one of these parts, say the cornea becomes a bit more curved, after millions of generations, these changes can result in a human eye. If the eye were a holistic entity, devoid of any parts, it could never have evolved by natural selection. That's why the theory of evolution cannot accept the idea of souls, at least if by soul we mean something indivisible, immutable, and potentially eternal. Such an entity cannot possibly result from a step-by-step evolution. Natural selection could produce a human eye because the eye has parts. But the soul has no parts. If the sapien's soul evolved step by step from the erectus soul, what exactly were these steps? Is there some part of the soul that is more developed in sapiens than in erectus? But the soul has no parts. You might argue that human souls did not evolve, but appeared one bright day in the fullness of their glory. But when exactly was that bright day? When we look closely at the evolution of humankind, it is embarrassingly difficult to find it. Every human that ever existed came into being as a result of male sperm inseminating a female egg. Think of the first baby to possess a soul. That baby was very similar to her mother and father, except that she had a soul and they didn't. Our biological knowledge can certainly explain the birth of a baby whose cornea was a bit more curved than her parents' corneas. A slight mutation in a single gene can account for that. But biology cannot explain the birth of a baby possessing an eternal soul from parents who did not have even a shred of a soul. Is a single mutation, or even several mutations, enough to give an animal an essence secure against all changes?